You are listening to the Business Society Podcast with Melissa Houston, CPA, financial strategist for CEOs, and a Forbes.com columnist. The Business Society community is where business owners come together to learn about real business, common problems, and real solutions. Are you a successful business owner who is now ready to learn how to increase your profit margins so that you can keep more money in your pocket and build your personal net worth? You are in the right place. With over 20 years of experience working with business owners, I share with you real advice that will help you increase the profit in your business and build your net worth. I know you're a genius at what you do, regardless of what profession you're in, and I'm here to help you make sense of the money and other pressing business issues. Have a business problem? We'll find real business solutions. Erin Austin is a consultant and lawyer who combines her 25 plus years of practicing law, including roles as COO and general counsel at IP-driven companies, to help the founders of expertise-based firms build and protect saleable assets so that the business is ready to sell when the founder is ready to exit. Erin's special talent is finding the Rembrandt in the attic, that hidden or overlooked asset that can be leveraged for maximum value. A graduate of Harvard Law School, Erin has been in-house and outside counsel and an executive for large and small companies, including Warner Brothers, Lionsgate, MGM, Teaching Strategies, and M3 USA Corp. She loves to share her experience, appearing in podcasts, webinars, and publications, including the Seven Figure Consultant podcast, City of Contracts podcast, and LegalZoom. In her spare time, Erin clears brush on her farmette, searches for the perfect gluten-free baguette, and plays her son's drums. Hi, Erin. Welcome to the Business Society Podcast. I am so happy to have you here today.
Thank you. I am very excited.
Good, because we are going to talk a lot about a subject that I really don't know. I know a little bit about, but I would never say like I'm an expert or even advanced in this area. So I know if you're helping me, you're going to be helping tons of listeners because this is a very, very important topic. So would you like to introduce yourself and your business and what it is that you offer people?
Yes. So I'm Erin Austin. I am a lawyer and consultant, and I work with the founders of B2B professional services firms to help them develop saleable assets so that the business is ready to sell when the founder is ready to exit. And what that really means is, you know, the assets in a service-based business are intellectual. You know, they aren't physical assets, they're intangible assets. And sometimes we don't think of our businesses when we are service providers or, you know, experts. We don't think of our business as being an asset-driven business. We think of it as being kind of a service and hours and the way, you know, kind of our inputs are our hours. And I like to change the conversation to make sure people understand you really do have assets in your business, but the only way for them to have value is to make sure that you're identifying them and protecting them and leveraging them appropriately. So that's what we do.
Awesome. So I guess a lot of this would be like courses or mini courses or programs, whatever have you.
They could be. So like the things that you just described are kind of your traditional intellectual property assets. I don't even use the term intellectual property too much because like that is a very narrow bucket of assets versus like the universe of assets that we may have in our businesses. So, I mean, I can chat about that if you want.
I would love to hear some examples.
Sure, sure. So intellectual property are those assets that get protection through the intellectual property laws. And so those are things, copyright, you know, this is U.S. law, of course, copyrights, trademarks, patents, and trade secrets. And those things, when properly registered or protected, you have the power of the law to protect those assets. That's intellectual property. There's a larger bucket of assets that are still intellectual, but may not fall into the bucket of intellectual property. So some examples of those may be your community. Like, let's say you have a community either online or an email list, and those aren't things that you're going to register somewhere, right? But that it is a very valuable asset. So that's something that you still want to, you know, make sure you protect and leverage, you know, either through products or through your business model. Another example would be, you know, insights that you may have. The fact that if you've been serving, you know, you have a niche where you're serving, you know, a client who serves the printing industry. And so she's been doing it for a dozen years. And so she really understands, you know, what's happening, what the pains are, what the future holds. And so she could leverage that into some sort of, you know, newsletter or things like that in order to share her insights. So there are tools that you may use internally. Like you may have, you know, an internal process that you use that hopefully you've set it up as an SOP or something. And that's how you make sure you deliver the reliable, consistent, you know, effective results to your clients, is that you have this process that you take them through. They might not know it, but you know it. And that's how you deliver your great results for your clients. And so that's not something that you register somewhere, but it is a very valuable asset.
So how do you protect that asset?
Well, you protect it by using it. I mean, that's really the main way. So let's take the asset of the standard operating procedure. So, you know, internally, you would obviously systematize it so that, you know, you become, even if you're a solopreneur, you become more effective. Certainly, if you have a team, when you systematize it, you help them. That's a way that you train them. You can delegate, and therefore you have a less expensive way of delivering the same result when you can use someone other than you to deliver it. And then, you know, you can protect it through using contracts. So when you have employees, you will have in their provision that make sure that they don't use your SOPs. They don't take them with them when they leave. Or if you have contractors, then you would have in your agreement with your contractors that this is confidential information and that you can't take it with you and use it with other clients.
Okay, I see the difference now. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about trademarking too, because I know that there is a lot of confusion out there around that as well, and when you need to trademark something.
Okay, so I'm not anti-trademarks, but I do think that a lot of times we don't always need them. Getting a trademark and being able to actually use it to prevent someone else from competing with you are actually two different steps. And so, because there's different strength of protection that you get depending upon the uniqueness of your trademark. So you might be able to get a trademark on something that is actually pseudo-generic and kind of weak. And I'm trying to think of a good example. So let's just take, Think Beyond IP. So Think Beyond IP, I could probably get a trademark in that. But there are some other law, there's a law firm somewhere that has Beyond IP. So there are other people who are using some version of it. And so could I get a trademark? Probably. If it came to it, would I be willing to spend the money to defend that trademark? I would not. And so I'm not going to say it's a vanity thing, because there's a whole industry, obviously, regarding trademarks. It's, you know, it does have value. But for most of us, and again, I'm talking about service providers mostly, as opposed to someone with a product, you know, having a trademark may not be necessary. Now, that said, it's not that expensive to do. There are trademark lawyers who have packages and they can, you know, do that for you. I want to say for under a couple thousand bucks. You can get their services. They can do the search for you to make sure there's nothing currently registered that would prevent you from getting a registration. And then they will have a process for making sure that you stay in compliance. You know, you got to refile every so often. You have to make sure you're using it in, you know, in commerce. So it's not just in your drawer somewhere, that you're actually using it in your business. But, you know, the key to the trademark is it has to be unique. It can't be like a translation of the thing in English. Like, it's, you know, what, you know, if you are plumber, you can't just use the French word for plumber and go, oh, you know, it's a trademark. It has to be, and it has to be something that's different. Like, again, using the plumber analogy, like, let's say, you know, the plunger guy. Well, maybe that would be protectable. Maybe that's too literal, right? Versus the, I'm not thinking of a good example of like what would be kind of interesting, something for a plumber that's still, you know, enough that you know he's kind of a plumber, but it's kind of an interesting take on it.
Like, I mean, pizzazzy plumber?
Yes. Tap dancing plumber. I don't know.
Yeah.
Singing plumber. You know, that like, you know, but, yeah. You know, something like that. Yeah. So that's like, okay, he's the singing plumber, you know, opposed to all the others. So yeah, there is a lot of confusion about trademarks.
Okay. And then can you lead us down the road for copyright?
Yeah. So copyright is, you know, basically the expression of something. So a copyright attaches at the moment of creation. Under U.S. copyright law, you don't have to register. There are rights that you get, such as the ability to sue someone who takes it if once you register. But as soon as you create something, you own the registration. So once I write it on my computer, I take my piece of paper, write it down, I put paintbrush to canvas, I take my picture. At that time limit of creation, I own it. And under copyright law, you're called the author when you're the one who creates it. So when we're talking about service-based businesses, often we will have agreements with clients where we are creating materials for them and the client will want to own everything, right? And that's why they have you sign these agreements. And you might, if you read your agreement, you'll see that there's a provision in there that talks about the ownership of the work product. And that addresses who owns the copyright in the materials you're creating. And the important thing also to consider is when you are hiring people to do work for you, like let's say you're subcontracting someone to work on a client project, you want to make sure that is in writing, because if you don't have something in writing, you don't own it under copyright law. So make sure that you're using your contracts, because unless you're personally creating it for yourself, then you need to make sure you have something in writing to make sure that you're not giving away your rights to your clients and that you're getting all the rights that you need from your subcontractors. And so that's, yeah, writings, drawings, photographs, film, those types of things that are covered, software is covered by copyrights.
So like if you're writing your blog, is that covered under copyright?
It is covered by copyright at the moment you create it. Yes, exactly.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So I know for service-based businesses, quite often we wouldn't be affected by patents, but let's cover that a little bit so people understand what a patent is.
I don't know anything about patents. It is
okay.
It is a very specialized area of the law. I mean, people are actually members of the patent bar, like it's a separate special bar. And so those lawyers are engineers, like they got their BAs in engineering or science, something like that, and then join the bar. So yeah, that is very specialized.
I think it's a lot about protecting like an idea or something, right?
Well, you have to at least have a prototype of some sort, because you do have, you actually register, you know, how to do it. But in exchange for registering it, you get exclusive use of it for the period of exclusivity. I actually don't have to know off the top of my head what that amount of time is, but yeah. But that becomes public. So that's why someone like Coca-Cola would never register their formula, because yes, they have a patent registration, but everyone in the world now knows what their formula is. And so, you know, and as we know, there are parts of the world where you can't get protection. So there are very good reasons to not register something when you really, truly need to make sure it stays confidential. And under those circumstances, we go to the fourth type of intellectual property, which is a trade secret. And so those items, which is what the Coca-Cola formula, or I think, you know, the KFC chicken formula.
I was just going to say the KFC secret spice.
And so you keep those secret. And so you get trade secret protection if you know, it's something that has real economic value, and that value be diminished if a third party, you know, had access to it, and that you're doing things to make sure it stays secret. So if you have, you know, you have your special tomato sauce and you have some secret ingredients in there. And so you want to keep it a trade secret, but you leave it laying around in a commercial kitchen, then you may lose and someone else takes it, starts, you know, using it. Like you may not be able to protect it because you're not taking reasonable measures to keep it secret.
I love that. I love the way you describe that. That clears up a lot for me. I really feel like I have a much better understanding of that. So what is the advantage of following through with all this protection?
Well, you know, I like to counsel people about how to build a business that they would be able to sell someday. And by that, I mean, it's saleable. And so by being saleable, it means that it actually has some market value to a third party. So the distinction that I make between sellable and saleable is something that's sellable just means that you own the rights to sell it. So let's say you have a car and you have the title. And so you can sell it. You're the owner, you have the title, you can sell it, it's sellable. But let's say that car can't pass inspection. It's rusted through. It's duct taped together. But you got the title. It's sellable, but no one in the world wants to buy it. Therefore, it's not saleable. And the same thing can happen with our businesses if we don't make sure that we are developing assets and protecting those assets. So you may have, let's call your business with a very generous income stream, selling your services, and you own it, and you, theoretically you could sell it. But if there's nothing to pass on to a third party, if the only way that business is making money is you providing a service, there's nothing to sell, you know, other than you becoming an employee of the buyer, right? That's the only thing you have to sell is your time, right? And so when we develop assets, if we develop intellectual property or we develop tools or systems or things that only our business has, so something that is exclusive to us, and we develop it in a way that it is leveraged. So it's not just selling our time, but we have systems in place. We have a process for onboarding clients. We have a process for delivery. We have a way that a buyer could see, buy this business, and I can see, you know, that these projections make sense. I can see how it can be integrated into my business. I can see how the business can be run without the owner. And those are the things that we want to make sure that we have so that we have a saleable business. And intellectual property is one leg of that. It's not the only leg, but it is one leg of that.
Okay. So here's a question, because I know I've heard it, you know, out and about wherever, where online business coaches in particular, they talk about how if you are operating under your own name, that you do not have a saleable business.
Well, that is not strictly the case. I mean, if you are operating under your own business, you have intellectual assets, you have, you know, a community of loyal followers, you have books, you have, you know, maybe you've certified people, like your coach, and you've certified other coaches to provide your coaching, you know, services the way that you are. So say you've developed a training system or certification system. Let's say you are the coach that you have a team and you are known for, you know, being able to, you know, turn around X type of business, you know, through your program. And so you have a really strong positioning, like you are the person, you know, you have, you know, your process, your system in order to make fighting teams work together like, you know, happy siblings. And so you have this really strong positioning and nobody else in the world is doing it. And you have, you know, let's say one of your big clients is Coca-Cola and you've worked with them and they have their HR department and they go, we have a gazillion million employees all over the world. We've been hiring Kate Smith Consulting to help us work with all of our teams all over the world, but we want to bring that in-house and we want to start using that training that she does. We wanted to bring it in-house and then we'll use it with our gazillion employees. That, even though they're not going to keep Kate Smith's name, but they will buy her program and buy her system in order to bring it in-house and then use it internally to train those employees. So, you know, the problem that you have, if it's named after you, it's because you're the only one who does the work. Nobody else can do the work. And then you have a problem. But it's not the fact of naming your business after yourself. It's not the problem.
Okay. So if you had programs like, I don't know, let's use me for an example. So I'm Melissa Houston, CPA, but I also have the Business Society blog, right? And the Business Society podcast and stuff like that. So as a business, I am saleable at some point, like, you know, when I'm actually worth something. But just for argument's sake, because I have these assets, does that make me saleable?
Well, saleable, it also means there is a market for it. So
are you saying there's no market for me? I'm just joking.
The fact that, you know, your CPA business is named after you is not an issue. But if, you know, you are the CPA person to, you know, online businesses and there is a, let's say there's a CPA, the larger CPA firm who just hasn't made inroads with online business. They just don't know that because it's different than brick and mortar businesses. And they go, okay, we want to add this wing to our business and we want someone who has a nice book and who's recognized in the industry. That could be, you know, it doesn't matter that it's named after you. If you have those, you've figured out how to serve this niche.
Awesome. That's a really good clarification. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how would you build a business where you got that leverage? You're not the only one who can perform these services. Do you have any advice around that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things. One is it's really important to have the right business model. And so many service providers start their businesses billing by the hour because I'm one of those people. Many of us came out of corporate America and our first client was our old employer. And we just kind of built a business where we were almost like a freelancing back to our employer. And we had the same, you know, hourly model in our head. And we can build a business that way, you know, and you can get a certain income out that way. But you will always be limited by the amount of time you put into it. And the only way to get more income is to put in more time. And while your revenue may grow, your profit will never grow. And scale requires increase in revenue and increase in profit, right? And so that's where your leverage comes in. How do you decouple your income from your time? And so assets are key to that. So other ways of doing it. So obviously an asset that you can make once and sell multiple times, you know, like a book or a course and things like that is one way to build leverage. The other way is to, you know, systematize your offering so that you can have other people help you deliver it. You know, you're the most expensive resource in your business. So how can you get less expensive resources to deliver it, whether it's through an employee or through automation or through technology and other ways to deliver some part of your offering. The other way is to develop services that can become more efficient the more that you deliver it. So productized services is one of those ways where you have, you know, kind of fixed fee, fixed scope, and you have a systematized way of delivering it. And so, you know, the more you deliver it, the better you get at it and the more profit that you get out of it. So those are some of the strategies I like to talk to my clients about how to create leverage in their business.
Yeah, that's really smart because it's like, you know, being on retainer, regardless of how many hours you've put in, you're guaranteed that income to come in that month.
Right. And okay. A lot of times, you know, with your clients, I mean, assuming that the engagement may be somewhat repetitive. Like every month you get a little bit better at it. You know, maybe the first month that, you know, your effective hourly rate was X, but the more you do it and more effective you get, the more systems you put in place, you know, to deliver it, it just becomes more profitable.
Okay, perfect. Well, this is amazing. If there's one particular, you know, takeaway that you want listeners to walk away with today, what would that be?
To think about the assets that may be in your business. I mean, again, like, and I am actually, you know, guilty of this. I came out of big business, you know, started my firm billing by the hour, and it took a while for me to get away from that and to start, you know, billing flat rates. And so I could build some leverage into my business, but start to think about those assets you could build. A lot of times they won't be those external assets like a course or a book. They will be the internal assets, the processes that you've developed, the tools that you've developed, you know, the data you may have acquired over the years of just performing these similar engagements over and over, and start thinking about the inputs to the deliverables and not the outputs. And that's probably where you're going to find your assets.
Oh, I love this. You've got me thinking. This is fantastic. This is great stuff, everyone. Okay. So I know people are going to want to reach out and, you know, try to connect with you. Where can we find you?
I hang out on LinkedIn at Erin Austin. And yeah, I've been on LinkedIn so long that I am Erin Austin. So just look me up. And then my website is thinkbeyondip.com. And if you go there, you can find, I have a freebie that's called, Is There a Rembrandt in Your Attic? So it helps you kind of think through what assets may be in your business.
That's perfect. And we are going to leave the links in the show notes. So I cannot thank you enough for this conversation. It's definitely been an eye-opener for me. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Thanks for listening to the Business Society Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. Your ratings and reviews help more people like you find our podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and share this podcast with someone you think would love it. Until next time, I'm Melissa Houston. And never forget, nobody will ever care about your money as much as you do. So never give your financial power away.